Welcome to episode 48 of Minal's World. I know it's been a while since I've been on the podcast and updated you all about my life, my work, and I guess the thing that you're all most interested about, which is Radhika. My last episode was the Women's Day special, where I added lots of different sound bites of all the incredible women who've shared their story with me, and I've just realized that was actually a month ago. But I remember editing that episode, and it took me almost 5 hours because I was trying to plan it out, and I don't think I was very organized in getting that ready. But I had my parents with me at that time, so it was fine because someone was looking after Radhika. And I think last month has been a big realization for me that actually, if you want to become successful, if you want to achieve everything you need, then you do need help. There's no such thing as someone who can do it all. It really does take a village to raise a child. But I'm here now, and I have a great interview lined up this week and in the next few weeks as well. This week I spoke to Kajal Odedra. She is the executive director of change.org, which is a platform where people can sign petitions and create change on a national level. And one of the great things about this episode was it made me realize that behind every campaigner and behind every activist is a story, and that story that they've, or any of the experiences that they've had in the past, has really shaped them to create, you know, these amazing changes in the world. And obviously Kajal talks about her story, but she also talks about how change can happen at a local level as well, and how everything is sort of interconnected, how politics isn't completely disconnected from society. There's lots of different ways that we can bridge that gap. So I loved talking to Kajal. We met a few months ago in a Christmas party, and it was really nice to reconnect again. So I hope you guys enjoyed this episode as much as I did speaking to Kajal. So without further ado, let's jump right into the show. Welcome to the show, Kajal. Last time I saw you, you were wearing a sparkly dress for Lauren's Christmas party. It's very different now. We're in our t-shirts and vests.
Yeah, don't spoil the myth. I'm wearing a sparkly dress still.
We can just tell everyone you are. No one's watching.
Yeah.
How are you doing, Kajal? It's been a few months since we've actually met, but we've never actually had a chance to individually connect with each other. So it's really nice to just sit down and have a nice chat with you.
Yeah, it's so great to meet you. I mean, it's so strange, isn't it, that in the last year of the pandemic, I've met and had connected and had, you know, real connections with people that I forgot that I've not actually even met in real life, because we've all had to adapt, and there have been so many, yeah, great events and kind of reasons to still continue meeting people. So, yeah, it'll be good to see you in real life when all of this is I'm doing okay. I think there's a bit of a, it feels like there's light now at the end of the tunnel, and just all the news of people getting vaccinated, it feels really good. So it's given me a bit of hope, yeah.
Yeah, I was in the park today, Kajal, with Radhika, and I saw, like, the park was completely packed, understandably so, because the weather's really nice and people just sort of escaped out, and you can just see, like, how much the kids need it, especially like children and their social contact. I think today was like just a big eye.
Yeah. I mean, the kids going back to school, I actually was walking through London the other day, and I saw so many kind of, you know, maybe 14, 15, 16 year olds. Like, it was school, it was at the end of the day. So for them, so it was like 3:30, 4 o'clock. And they were just being so giddy and hysterical on the streets and hugging each other and chatting, and there was just so much energy, and it made me realize they must have really, God, this must be amazing for them to come back together again at school. So yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? We've all gone through something, and it will be amazing when we can actually come back together. I think the country's going to feel amazing. I really, you know,
definitely
hopeful for that.
You know, Kajal, I've actually just come back from Gibraltar, which is where I'm from originally, and over there, things are pretty much back to normal. It's one of the first countries in the world to be fully vaccinated. So I was there, right? And I was so, like, worried. I was like, Mom, we need to, like, distance ourselves. She's like, just chill. Like, over here, it's fine. And, like, nobody needs to wear masks anymore outside. So things are things are back to normal.
That's incredible.
I went from that to, like, coming back here into lockdown. So the first, like, 10 days was so difficult because I had to be in complete isolation.
Yeah.
And with Radhika as well, I mean, my mind was just going crazy.
So I think today was just like a really nice day of reflection.
Yeah.
To just appreciate, you know, everything we've gone through. But
yeah,
Kajal, I've been following your work for a long, long time. And when Lauren said that you would be at the same Christmas party in December, I was actually very honored. Like, you know, I was on the same panel as you, and just also seeing someone from like my, someone with my skin color, someone who will understand what I've been through as well.
Totally, you know, yeah.
It just sort of brings like a fuzzy feeling in your heart. And actually, you know, that togetherness and that connection was there. I listened to your TED talk and you spoke about how your parents had moved from Uganda to the UK, and your dad had a shop and he was very vocal as well in his own community. Mm. Is that how things started for you, would you say, like watching your father speaking up to power and speaking the truth?
Yeah, I think I'd say I would actually, because I get asked this question sometimes, and I'd say it's a mixture of things. It would be quite a nice, neat bow if it was like one moment and that kind of, you know, sealed it all. But I think there was a few things. One of the things was the fact that, yeah, we were one of the only Black or Asian families in the village. You know, I'd say probably one of four families, and it's a very big village. And I didn't come into contact with other people of colour. And so I went from being in Leicester, which was a very Asian, Black and Asian area, to this village and not seeing anybody like me. And I probably was around, you know, 7 years old. And so I think that just started, it started just shifting my perspective and feeling like an outsider at school, in the village. And I think once you start seeing the world as an outsider and you start seeing that you're being treated differently because of the way you look and because of your identity, it does something. And I think it can, and especially as a child, you start realizing from a very early age that life isn't just, you know, that there are injustices, and that because I think maybe a lot of young people grow up just not realizing that until they're a little bit older. And so it was partly that. And then, you know, seeing my dad, we got harassed a lot whilst I was growing up, and the shop was across the road from the house. So it was very visible as well. There was a gang that would every day kind of start congregating or outside of the shop, kind of mostly boys and young men, and start shouting things, and it was very intimidating. And dad basically fought for years to get the authorities to do something about it. And so there was this real sense of fight in our house. Mm. Then, you know, I'm one of four daughters, and so on top of that, and you know, you may have experienced this, but being in the Indian community, especially the community I'm from, you know, it would be reinforced to you that, you know, the boys were the preferred gender. And, you know, you want to, you know, every mother, pregnant person is like, the community is hoping that they have a son. And the boys just got treated differently. They have more freedom and more independence. And so even there, I felt like we were the kind of the second sex, but my dad refused to acknowledge that. And so I remember being in India once with him, and an old friend of his bumped into us at the temple, and she was chatting away, and she was like, oh, so dad was like, this is my daughter, and he said, you know, and was telling her that I'm one of four, and she said, oh, no boys. And dad said, they're my boys. And that really speaks to the way he raised us, which was, if anything ever happens, you stand up for each other, you stand up for yourself. And so when I was experiencing racism and bullying at school, it was my older sister that would come to the playground and stick up for me. So I think there was just this sense of fight built into my upbringing that then I started really vocalizing. So I decided I wanted to be on the school council. And like, you know, then when I went to university, I decided I wanted to be on the committee. And I didn't realize this, but I think that that's when that kind of sense of like, well, I have an opinion and it's important, and I want to vocalize what my friends and the people in my class are saying, and I want to fight for that. And so I think that's when the seeds really started being kind of nurtured, I think.
It's really interesting you said that, Kaju, because now that I think about it, my parents as well, you know, they had the same like line of thinking as your father did as well, that you speak the truth and you fight for what you believe in and you fight for what is right. But I feel like that only sort of that only really set into my mentality and in my brain now, like all these years down the line. Like as a child, I think I was still too afraid to speak up and to fight for what I believed in, because I felt like I was nobody in you know, big pool of so many people. Do you think that your father's values now still play a big role in like how you make decisions and how you move forward?
100%, absolutely. I mean, yeah, I mean, I'd say that, you know, I'd say everybody in my family, like the six of us, are all very strong-minded, and that's something that we've adopted. I think that the fact that mum and dad pulled us out of the Indian community in Leicester, and we grew up in this village. It was a very white working class village. And even though that was difficult because I didn't feel like I fitted in, I think it was probably useful because it meant that I never fell into groupthink, or I never fell into what was comfortable or what everybody else was doing, because I didn't feel like I was like everybody else. And I think that, you know, there are lots of young Asian people growing up who maybe have this kind of sense of fight in them, but they can't quite speak up because it can be hard to speak up in the community, and that in itself can be quite stifling and hold you back. So I feel lucky to have kind of gone through that experience. And then now, I mean, you know, it's interesting that my other sisters have gone down different paths, and I went down the you know, real like kind of campaignery kind of fighting back. And I think at the beginning, I went into the charity sector, and I think at the beginning my parents weren't really sure what it was all about and whether I would be paid and, you know, all of this. But now he loves it, and I do some work with our team in India sometimes, and he absolutely loves that because he watches Indian news, and sometimes our director in India will pop up on the news and he just loves it. So yeah, it's definitely
come like full circle now. It feels like your dad has passed the baton on to you now to continue fighting for, you know.
Yeah, and it's interesting because my cousin in India is actually in politics as well, and so I never was really conscious of that, but I think that that's definitely kind of, it was probably meant to be.
And Kajal, in your TED talk, you mentioned something that really sort of struck a chord with me, because you mentioned how social media, especially and the internet, has created like a level playing field for people to vocalize what they believe in and vocalize what they feel that they need. And I asked this question because when I started podcasting a few years ago, internet was a completely different place. And this was just maybe 4 or 5 years ago. It wasn't that long ago. Starting a podcast at that time, vocalizing my own opinions of not just our community, but of the world, seemed to be quite different in the sense that people would pick you up and it was a bit easier to stand out from the crowd. Whereas now, and I would say especially in the last year, it almost feels like when you try to say something in the internet, it's drowned by everybody else's opinions, and it's very difficult to stand out. Do you feel that's the case? Do you still feel like the internet is a level playing field for everybody? Do you think that's changed now?
Yeah, I think that's, you know, it's a good observation. In the last year, internet, I mean, certainly from change.org perspective, we released a report last year, halfway through the pandemic, where we'd done an analysis of the use of our platform in all of the countries that we're in, and found that people starting petitions and people signing petitions had both increased at around 80%. 80% increase is phenomenal. And, you know, working for an internet platform, you don't, you know, I've been working here for nearly 8 years. You don't see that kind of increase usually, but I think what happened was that everybody was at home watching the news, feeling very frustrated. You can't shake it off by going about your daily business. And so what do you do with that energy? Well, one thing you can do is start a petition or sign a petition or write something on social media. And, you know, also, you know, that as well as the fact that we desperately wanted to still be connecting with each other. So I think that internet activity has increased in the last year. But I think that I worry sometimes that about social media. I still think it's, I don't think fundamentally it has opened up access to anyone who has access to the internet, and you can't take that away. Like that is true, and it may have been easier to stand out a few years ago, but that's probably because there were people who weren't still having access at that point. And right now I'd say more people are accessing the internet. And that is a good thing, because if you think about the fact that, you know, someone like you or I, or I worked with this young girl from Bristol, from the Somali community back in 2013. And we worked on a campaign for the UK government to address the issue of FGM in the UK. And her name's Farmer, and she wears a hijab. And I remember, and it became really successful. And in the end, we won the campaign, which was for the Department for Education to engage in schools in FGM, because what was happening and what Farmer and her friends had told me was that, you know, during the summer, often these girls can be sent away. So even though we think that it may not be a problem in the UK, it's because those girls are being sent away during the summer holidays. And it's called the cutting season. And then they'd be brought back. And Farmer and her friends were saying, well, if we actually train teachers up to identify what to look for, the warning signs, then maybe that could be an intervention. And so it was a really important campaign. And I remember thinking at first, I wonder if people are going to sign this because it's being because of the topic, because it doesn't affect most people in the country, and because of who's starting it. And actually what happened was that it grew to over 300,000 signatures. It was on countless front pages, and she ended up having a meeting with the government, and it was an amazing campaign. And I remember thinking that, you know, someone like Farmer would not have had the opportunity to get her face seen and her voice heard and be face to face with Michael Gove at the decision maker table if it wasn't for the internet. So whilst the status quo is that, you know, there are certain types of people in power, the internet will still be an important place for us to actually level that playing field, because until the institutions actually create a route for more people, more normal, ordinary people to be in those positions, then we're just going to have to keep elbowing our ways in. And so that's, I think it's still important. And I think it's still, it still works. And, you know, just looking at for example, just even in the last few weeks of the activism around sexual harassment in schools, and, you know, it's a way for us. I think that usually you would have to go behind the scenes, and your kind of lobbying and activism would have to happen and you, behind closed doors. And if you're ignored, there's not a lot you can do about it. Now, there's also just like a level of accountability that the internet has created, which is just, I think it's important for people power.
Yeah. Kajal, are you very involved in like specific campaigns as in your position at the moment with change.org, or was that something you were just doing at the beginning?
Yeah, so I'm now on the exec director in the UK. So that I, but I, so I don't get the chance to, no, unfortunately, to be that hands-on, but there's an amazing, you know, small team. I think, I'm not sure, people sometimes think that we're a bigger team than we are. There's five of us in the UK. And so, yeah, before I would have been the campaigner, kind of being in touch with the petition starter and helping them with the strategies. Now it's our incredible team of campaigners and comms experts who do that.
Because the thing is, like, I'm just thinking of myself in your position a few years ago, for example, and trying to help people with their campaigns. How was it? Because you must have been quite emotionally invested in all the campaigns. And I mean, from the last year, at least we can see a lot of us are quite exhausted with trying to, you know, scream from the rooftops and trying to voice our opinion. How was that for you? Because when you switch your laptop off, it's not like you can just switch your brain off and say, you know, I'll come back to it at 9 o'clock tomorrow. It must be going through your head all the time. So what was that like for you?
No, and also it's not a 9-to-5 job, because the petition starter doesn't stop needing help at 5 p.m. and then start, you know. Mm. So often I used to describe the role of the campaigner as a part journalist, part social worker, because on the one hand, we're looking for great, powerful, meaningful, impactful stories and trying to create strategies to get those stories in front of the right decision makers. And at the same time, we're giving a lot of emotional and pastoral support to the petition starter. Often this person is going through the hardest time they've ever experienced in their life, right? They've either, you know, they're fighting for their housing, or they're fighting for better healthcare for their loved one. And you're kind of parachuted into their life at this very difficult moment. And, you know, we hold their hands through the whole process. And so, and that can be really, yeah, it's I don't know if I'd say it's exhausting work, definitely, and it's not 9-to-5 work. You know, often you'd be on the phone texting at night, on the phone at the weekends, but then and I'd say that, you know, that's all, you know, it's exhausting, but then imagine what it's like for the petition starter who's going through this. And then the other thing I'd say is that it's just an incredible feeling being able to help someone at that moment in their life. And, you know, even if the campaign doesn't win, you're giving them support and confidence in themselves, because you're not only saying, no, you've got a right to speak up, you know, you with your lived experience are an expert on this. Mm. You know, no matter what anyone says, you're an expert in this. And look at all these people who are signing the petition who are in your corner. So that's an incredible thing. And, you know, often, like, many of the petition starters I've worked with, I'm still in touch with, and I love it. I love seeing them. And, like, yeah, it's just, it's a really, it's very, very special. And I feel very fortunate to go through that. Now I'd say that what we are trying to do, I think, you know, this was a few years ago, and what we've realized is that the support that a handful of us in our team can give to our petition starters, we can probably only really support 1% of the campaigns that are started on our site, because there's hundreds, there's thousands started every day. And what we're trying to do is create this platform that can help everybody to win the campaign and, you know, create the change that they want to see. What that means then is, if we're only able to support, say, 1% of the campaigns, there's 99% of petition starters who still, you know, they've started their petition, but they're not really sure what to do next. And so now the team we're basically testing and experimenting and trying to really scale the support that we give by, for example, creating more meaningful tips and guides for petition starters, trying to think about, like, and build experiments for how can we reach as many petition starters as we can this week, what kind of tests and experiments can we run. So yeah, we're trying to, back in the day when I was definitely a campaigner, we would maybe support a handful of petition starters because we just didn't have the capacity to do much more. But now we're really trying to think about how we can scale that support.
Hmm. So Kajal, how does it work when someone starts a petition to taking it to the leaders at number 10? Because, you know, one of the things that happened to me last year was, I remember it was around this time, actually, exactly a year ago, when I was speaking up saying, like, this is crazy. Like, doctors are dying. Why is nobody speaking up? And the majority of people around me were, A, scared to speak up, and B, also just kind of like, well, this is life. Like, you know, there are people at the top. They make the decisions. We follow them. And that was the, you know, it was very cathartic. Everyone was just sort of trying to get on with it. And obviously it was a pandemic. So our priority was just to get to work, do our job and come home and just sort of survive.
Yeah.
How, what would you say to people? Because I've been finding it very difficult to explain to people like the power you can actually have as a single person. And obviously on change.org and on the website, you've seen people start a petition and then, as you mentioned, this Somali girl gone and made a huge, huge change on a national level. How do you help petitioners like actually go through that process? Because it must be quite scary, especially for someone as young as you mentioned.
Well, first of all, I'd say that often, so Farmer at the time, she was 16, 17, and I'd say that they are probably the bravest campaigners. The you know, young people that I work with are often, this is why I just love working with young people on campaigning, because they're idealistic and fierce and don't take no for an answer. And I think they're the things that you need in a good campaigner. But you're right that if you're I've worked with a single dad campaigning for his kids' better healthcare, and they are, you know, because you're drummed into your, like, we're told all our lives that, you know, you need to respect authority and you need to adhere to certain norms and practices. And that doesn't include, especially in British culture, that doesn't include, you know, being complaining and being negative and, you know, shouting out about those in power. So you're right, it can be really intimidating. So once a person starts a petition, we actually have lots of tips and guides on the platform. So, you know, change.org, we're a tech company, and with you could say we're a tech company with people on the ground who are trying to kind of get people more of the human touch support. But our amazing engineers work round the clock to create the best tools for petition starters. There's nobody really out there doing something like this, where we're actually, you know, we have dedicated teams of engineers who are thinking every single day about what happens when a person comes to our platform. They want to start a petition. What do they need to do next? Will they be scared to contact their local media? What can we do? What are the things that we can create on the platform to make that process and that step a little bit easier and a little bit less intimidating for them? And what should happen when you start a petition is that you get lots of kind of nudges, hints. You know, if you put a picture on your petition, it's more likely to be shared on social media, for example. If you tell more of a story in your petition, people are more likely to engage with it and want to share that story. And then throughout, you've got this kind of dashboard with all of these kinds of, you know, I want to reach out to the media, I want to contact my local representative. And then really it's, you know, it's either we will, you know, you'll get some tips and guides about how to write to your MP. The journey of a campaign can be so different from one to the next. One day you could just wake up and somebody famous has seen your petition and they've tweeted it and it just goes viral, and then all of a sudden you've got journalists calling you, and then, you know, and then one thing leads to another. For others, and, you know, the way that I would I actually, you know, wrote a whole book on this because it was really important to me that I worked in activism for about 15 years, and it was always striking to me that how to run a campaign is not rocket science. It just isn't rocket science. But for some reason, we've not made it really easy and accessible for people to understand how to run campaigns. So, you know, the charities I would work in, or I'd be speaking with an MP's office, and it would be like, okay, yeah, easy. We want to work on this issue. We just need to do X, Y, Z. Next, we need to do this and we need to do that. And it's very strategic, but it's kind of, there's a bit of a formula to it. And it was striking to me that we, you know, still, you know, 15 years on, this information really isn't available to people, which I think is, I think it's a right as a citizen to have this kind of information.
Absolutely.
And so I wrote about it, and I basically, like, I boil it down to, you know, tell your personal story because your lived experience is an expertise. You know, how to write the best, how to kind of come up with the best petition ask, making it tangible, you know, how to write a campaign strategy, how to contact the media. What is the media actually looking for when they are, one thing that's always been really interesting to me is that whenever I speak to petition starters, they can be quite intimidated by going to journalists. But what you need to remember is that journalists also need to get their job done as well, and they need stories. And so you're both really helping each other out. And then, you know, how to build a community. And so I'd say that what I'd say is, if anyone is listening and wants to start a campaign, it's not rocket science, and there is information out there. So don't be intimidated. And often whatever you've planned, it never goes that way anyway. So, but having a plan is good.
You know, Kajal, you mentioned how certain positions can change from one day to the next, and how one day you can just start your position, next day journalists are calling you. I mean, I went out to Downing Street. I still remember.
Yeah.
So Sunday, the next morning, Kajal, and I always remember I was heavily pregnant as well. I didn't eat breakfast till like 4 p.m. because my phone was just going off and people were just wanting to know what was going on. And I think that's when I realized, Kajal, is that we almost see journalists as a like completely separate entity. They're only there to like serve politicians. They're only there to write out what's happening at these meetings in Westminster, number 10. But actually, they're also there for the public. They're also there to raise our stories and raise our voices. And I think this year especially, like, journalists have had such an important role in shaping the views of the community and helping, like, people who've been on starting petitions as well.
Journalists, they to do their job well, they need stories and they need to speak to people. They need to be interviewing people. And so you are helping them. It's just that what we need to, and I guess, you know, just like many institutions in this country, the media is also, you know, very, you know, it's misogynist. It's, you know, it's an elite industry, and that is true. And so I wouldn't, you know, it's not like your kind of the people feeling intimidated is coming out of nowhere. That, you know, there's a reason for it, but there are still journalists out there who, you know, well, first of all the journalists, if they're working on a story, they need that kind of, you know, if you're writing about, for example, you know, the government PPE, the stuff that you're campaigning about, you are such a valuable asset to them because you're a trained expert and you're speaking out and you're, you know, you have a story to tell. That is so, so, so valuable because it basically makes their story far more interesting and far more compelling. But it's just about understanding how to speak to journalists, because there is a bit of a, you know, if you're, you know, journalists are very busy people. And so, you know, kind of getting that right is quite important. But, you know, the other thing I'd say is that so many journalists out there are kind of campaigners, really. They think, you know, I used to want my kind of like the two paths I was considering going down was like either journalism or into activism, because, you know, the kind of the telling of a story is a form of activism. And many journalists, they don't want to just the story to end at their article. They want to keep working on this. So if you can give them a reason to write another story, then, you know, then do that, package it up for them and give it to them, because they're likely they'll be very, very grateful.
Mm. Hey, Kagel, you mentioned different forms of activism, and that just like, you know, made me think, when people see me, for example, or people see yourself or anybody on the internet, they think, okay, if I want to create a change, I'm going to have to go outside Downing Street and protest, or I'm going to have to do something really big for people to hear me. But I personally feel that actually activism starts, like they say, charity starts from home. I think activism and campaigning also starts from home, because especially in our communities, and, you know, not just South Asian communities and, you know, lots of different types of communities, we as either women or as wives or as daughters are sometimes told, don't speak up. This is not your place to say anything, or we're always intimidated by that. And I always feel like a lot of it actually starts from home. And, you know, me going out to Downing Street, that wasn't just my first, that wasn't the first time I spoke up. I've been speaking up a lot, but it was always at home and in my family. Mm. And I think that's where everything sort of built up. And I said, okay, now I can go out and speak out. What would you say to people who feel that maybe they don't have much power just sitting at home?
Oh, yeah. I mean, look, the most influential people in your life are your friends and family. You know, if you think about, I think about this a lot with polarization of society and the fact that, you know, there are certain topics and issues right now where as a society, we seem to be divided and we can't quite see eye to eye. Take the, for example, just a few weeks ago, the Meghan Markle interview, that seemed to create another division in society. Those who were supportive and defensive of the royal family, those who were supportive of Meghan and Harry. And you're never going to, like, if you are strongly in one of those camps, you won't change your mind by seeing a tweet or reading an article. You just won't. But you might change your mind if you're spending the evening or you're spending the day going on a walk with your dad and you're having a chat about it. Because there's some, I wish I had it to hand, but there's some great research out there that says that if you see a friend or family member share a post on social media, you're more likely to engage in it than if it's from a stranger. So, and it makes sense because you already have that implicit trust. That trust is already there. So you're already kind of coming at something from a place of, I guess, mutual respect. And that just makes you more likely to engage in it and potentially, you know, be a bit more open-minded. And the other thing I'd say is stories change people's minds, not statistics. And it's the stories that we remember, not the stats. So a good example of this is the campaign to repeal the Eighth Amendment that would basically, when, so this was about legalizing abortion in Ireland. And a few years ago, there was a huge campaign and it led to abortion being legalized. And it was the Eighth Amendment that basically, that was in the way of this in the Constitution. And campaigners who'd been working on this for years realized, and they knew that it was stories that would change people's minds. And it wasn't, you couldn't go door to door saying, you know, talking about the rights of people who are pregnant. That wouldn't engage somebody. But talking about somebody as a daughter, as a wife, as a mother, and telling that story, what it did was it just disarmed people and made them more likely to just think twice about their own views about the issue. So I would just say that, yeah, I mean, when it comes to campaigning, really what you're trying to do is influence the decision maker. But if you really want to change the minds, the hearts and minds of people, you know, everyday people, start with the people in your life. And because they won't be persuaded by an article, but they might be persuaded by a conversation with you.
Hmm. That's really interesting, Kajal. And I think stories is really, you know, when you say that stories resonate with people, I think that's what's really amplified this year, that lots of people have actually come out and shared their stories, their personal stories. And I think that's what's really connected with people. And I think that's why this year has been so important in, like, you know, the future that we're going to see in the next few years, and what Radhika, for example, my daughter is going to see. Kajal, you've done a lot of work in campaigning and helping lots of people, like, get their voices heard. How important do you feel it is to, like, campaign at a grassroots level? Because, you know, a lot of people have spoken to me and said, well, would you ever consider going to politics? Because maybe a politician might give you more power and have more change. But there's always a part of me that says that actually there's a difference between actually creating a change and educating people. And I feel like that's also just as important. So how do you feel about that? I mean, as someone who's been involved in activism and campaigning, would you ever consider politics?
Well, first of all, I think you should consider politics. I think I think we need more. I think I really, really think it needs to be. I feel quite passionate about this, that it needs to be more a part of our culture and more of an accessible thing that we all consider in our lives, because, you know, I think it is. It's not. It's just, we need our parliament to reflect society, and until it's more part of our culture to stand for election, we won't get that. And so we need more people to be doing things like that. And I think you'd be amazing at it. I think of the whole kind of, like, the landscape of I guess, like, campaigning and activism as. So you've got kind of the charities, you've got your big charities, you've got small charities, you've got your individuals on the grassroots, you've got community groups, you've got MPs. And I think that, you know, together it's like an orchestra, and they're greater than the sum of their parts. So you need each person and each body in that landscape to be playing their part. At sometimes, you know, the horns need to be a bit quiet. At other times, the strings need to go really, really loud, but the most important thing, I think, is that there's collaboration. And one of the things that I try to do in kind of, because I feel like change.org, we sit almost like as a bridge between grassroots and the charity sector. And so what I try to do with my work with charities is try to just encourage more collaboration and more of a connection between the two. And some of the most amazing campaigns we've worked on at change.org has been a partnership between a petition starter and an MP, because the MP can be the best campaigner in Parliament, rallying up, you know, 300, 600 people in Parliament to try and vote for something, tabling debates. The petition starter can rally up the public, get people to write to their MP to get them to turn out to that debate. So that is a beautiful match made in heaven. And I'd love for us to be doing more of that kind of thing. And there are some MPs out there who are just really, really, really great at just spotting that there's this person who started a petition, and they'll get in touch with them and they'll say, let me know how I can help you. I think, you know, as an MP, it truly is, you're a servant to the constituents, your constituents, and you're a servant to the country. And I think that that's such an honourable job. And I wish more people felt the compulsion to just want to do it. And I think part of the problem is that it feels quite scary. It feels like, where would I start? But there's some amazing organizations out there, by the way. There's a great organization that I've done some work with called the Parliament Project that I recommend people look up if they're thinking about it. And, you know, if you are considering it, or it's a little twinkle in your eye, then I'd start doing it now. Because you just want to start learning, start getting to know people.
Well, that's the thing, Kajal. I think, like, I'm slowly, last year was the first time I think I really, like, put my head into politics to understand the system. And as you mentioned correctly, I think, you know, it's really important that we all understand how, in reality, the ideal situation would be that politicians work well with the community and they work in harmony, and, you know, we create the change we want. Obviously, it doesn't happen like that, but we're made to believe that that's not how it works because we're so afraid to go at that level. I think you made a really good point saying how we have that power we just need to work together with our local MPs. And I think that's really important, because throughout the year, I think a lot of change has happened because people have written to their local MPs.
Yeah.
And it has been as simple as that, you know, write a letter to the local MP and you can get things moving.
Totally. Look, people, like, I see it time and again. I'm so convinced of it that I forget that people aren't, other people aren't. And but it's people power that has got things like hospital cop, you know, the medics didn't, up until a few months into the pandemic, NHS doctors and nurses still had to pay for their hospital car parking. And it was people power that got that stopped. And that was a campaign that people have been working on for years, and it just was never getting anywhere. And then all of a sudden the pandemic, the government was like, yeah, for this pandemic, we shouldn't be charging people. And it's people power that has lobbied to get people who are pregnant to be allowed to have their partners into wards. So there was, like, just time and again, I've seen people power work. And I actually think, you know, the time is now to really change society in the way that we want it to be. So, you know, things like 4-day weeks, you know, more flexible working, like, these are the things that I think we can really be pushing for, because it's almost like the pandemic has made us all, like, just stop. And now that we are slowly kind of coming back to life again, we can't miss this moment. It's like, it's a window of an opportunity.
Yeah, I think this pandemic has hit a really hard reset button on the whole system. And I think it's been so important just for our democracy, for our society, because now people realize the power they have to speak up, thanks to platforms like change.org, where people have actually managed to create change on a national level and inspire other people to use their voice and power as well. Bakajal, thank you so much for joining me today. It was such a nice chat. I wish I could go on longer, but unfortunately Radhika's going to get hungry very soon.
Oh no, feed Radhika. She's so hungry. Thank you so much for having me. Yeah, it was so lovely, and I'm excited to meet you in IRL.
And hopefully, you know, maybe Radhika will start her own petition on change.org. Oh. Like, she might start a lemonade stand or something, I don't know. Oh.
She could be a little mini petition starter, a little mini
activist.
When she's
testing, I'm just going to direct her to you.
Yeah, please. Yeah. I'll be her mentor.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Kajal. And if people want to get in touch with you, how can they do that?
Yeah, so I'm on social. So I'm on Instagram at Kajal Odedra, and on Twitter at Kajal Odedra 1, because somebody took Kajal Odedra on Twitter.
No, it's because you're number one. That's why.
Yeah, exactly.
Thank you so
much, Kajal. Thank you so much.
Okay, bye-bye. And thank you, dear listeners, for tuning in this week. And thank you for for being patient with me as well. I really hope that at some point, you know, we can really make this as consistent as possible and make sure that I can continue with my Tuesday morning podcast as well. I really enjoy doing those, but it's just one of those things that I just have to accept, that there will be times where I'm able to show up and there are times that I can't. And a lot of it really is dependent on childcare. And unfortunately, my parents do live in Gibraltar. So let's hope that things become a bit easier. Things are easing down in terms of lockdown. So wherever you are in the world, I hope you're safe. I hope your loved ones are safe. Thank you for tuning in, and we have a great episode lined up next week as well. Remember, I've left Kajal's contact details in the show notes. You can also get in touch with me on Instagram and Twitter at MenalsWorld, or you can email me at menalsworldpodcast@gmail.com. I hope you all have a lovely week. Stay safe.